coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Only two First Aid school districts have formal policies outlining protections for transgender and gender nonconforming students.
When sending my now 13-year-old into school where they are seen and heard, they can use whatever bathroom they're comfortable with, I don't mind sending them to school. I don't question what's going to happen.
Our Rachel Sawicki examines efforts to create those policies and the arguments for why they're needed. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at possible avenues to better serve the needs of those facing homelessness, addiction, and mental health issues. Arts Playlist highlights the latest exhibition at the Brandywine Museum of Art. And History Matters previews Delaware's role in a nationwide celebration of a hero of the American Revolution. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Just two of Delaware's 19 school districts have a formal policy outlining protections for transgender and gender nonconforming students, ensuring their preferred names and pronouns are used by all other students and staff, and allowing students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms and play on sports teams that align with their gender identity. This week, Delaware Public Media's Rachel Sawicki explores the need for these policies and how the districts that have them created them.
I saw a lot of people come out after leaving because it wasn't a space that was easy to be trans in.
Fina Grimes graduated from Indian River in 2017. Grimes identifies as transmasculine non-binary and says they've always presented that way, but were never in an environment where they could explore what their gender identity was, let alone come out as trans.
I feel like it was probably the first year I went to college that I actually started like actively using different pronouns. And I feel like that was a thing for a lot of people who went to Indian River.
Grimes endured constant bullying, verbal and physical. They regularly heard slurs and once had a facial piercing ripped out by a classmate on the bus, leaving them feeling unwelcome in any space at school, but especially the locker room.
I remember having like my shirt off and like girls like making like a very weird, "Are you going to like do something to me?" kind of comment. And it's like, are you going to do something to me? I'm literally half naked.
K-Penlopen parent Diane Scarantino says her child is currently experiencing similar events. She says after a bullying incident that turned physical, her transgender son was returned to the same gym class it happened in, where verbal harassment ensued.
I am definitely not going to say the school's failed, but I can definitely say they need some improvement in the culture in the schools for the kids and maybe the staff too.
Stories like these have prompted efforts to create policies to address how schools protect LGBTQ plus students' rights and the bullying they often face, specifically trans students. Licensed clinical social worker Reverend Carla Fleshman runs Transitions Delaware, a counseling consultation and training service for LGBTQ youth, young adults, and their families. In 2019, she wrote an article for the Delaware Journal of Public Health outlining four pillars to create safer and more inclusive schools for LGBTQ youth, the first of which is implementing policies that protect all youth across the spectrum of sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression, or SOGI. She argues creating clear school policies using this model is about more than just handling bullying in the moment.
Unaddressed bullying impacts us. It changes our brains. When you are in trauma on a regular basis, the research shows the connection between trauma, autoimmune disease, and the research shows the connection between LGBTQ youth experiencing trauma and how that impacts them in school and after school. This is a health crisis not taken care of all of our kids.
Fleshman notes anti-bullying policies that are explicitly inclusive of SOGI and are enforced show a significant reduction in the risk of suicide attempts in LGBTQ plus youth in both middle and high school, and they also give teachers more tools to help their students.
Then they actually are hung out to dry when a parent who is not safe, who is not affirming, and who actually can be outright dangerous to the kiddo comes in. That's how we end up with statistical research shows most of our homeless youth are LGBTQ. And most of our homeless youth who are LGBTQ ended up being homeless because of physical, emotional, sexual abuse in the home.
In Delaware, the Christina School District was the first to pass a policy with protections for transgender and gender nonconforming students in early 2021. Board member Claire O'Neill says the effort started with then board member Elizabeth Page, who resigned in March 2020. O'Neill took over, reaching out to transgender advocates to help fine-tune Page's draft and get it across the finish line. The policy follows the SOGI model, asserting that students have the right to be addressed by the name and pronouns that correspond to their gender identity. Students can also use the bathroom or locker room that corresponds with their gender identity, but may also request a single stall or private restroom or changing area.
Once you provide the safety and security for people to just be who they want to be, that you realize that they've been there all along and that they've been hiding and that they've been scared and sad and things can be different if you just support them for being who they are.
To the surprise of many, the district didn't face much backlash at all.
Zero people showed up for public comment or emailed us at all about this policy, except in the positive, like, yay, finally. Somebody is doing something.
And O'Neill says it wasn't a heavy lift. She says across the board, students and administrators said these practices were already happening.
That our teachers and our administrators are acting in the best interest of our students. I know that that is not happening everywhere in the United States.
The Red Clay School District also created a formal policy in 2021, similar to Christina's, in that students have a right to choose how they're addressed and which gendered facilities they use. But Red Clay's experience passing it was much different.
And that was really sad and hard to experience, certainly a challenge for our district and the greater community. It was a meeting that was, it was violent and it was very contentious.
That's Red Clay School Board President Jose Matthews, who says he spent his first several years on the board drumming up enough political will to pass the policy.
Even though the issue had been brought up prior to me being on the board, it takes, you know, sometimes years of advocacy until you can get to a point where you have, you know, the ability to see the change that we needed to see.
Matthew says they relied on other examples of successful policies across the country, plus local expert voices, to shape their own. They also sought legal advice to explore all possible outcomes.
You know, if you don't pass a policy like this, making sure that we have a process and protections in place for gender nonconforming students and trans students, the case law time and time and again, when challenged, has proven that, you know, they do have rights, and we, you know, they are American citizens. They are people who have rights. And if we violate their rights, we will be sued, and for a lot of money.
State Representative Deshaun O'Neill played a hand in creating Red Clay's policy, noting their own struggles to find a supportive school for their transgender child, who they homeschooled until high school.
When sending my now 13-year-old into school, where they are seen and heard, they can use whatever bathroom they're comfortable with, I don't mind sending them to school. I don't question what's going to happen.
But Neil understands the difficulties of delivering a policy that works. Both policies say that when contacting the parent or guardian of a transgender or gender diverse student, school personnel should use the student's legal name and the pronoun corresponding to the student's gender assigned at birth, unless the student, parent, or guardian has specified otherwise, which Neil explains is a way to prevent the school from outing a student that isn't ready to tell their family. A draft of Red Clay's plan included requiring parental approval to use a student's preferred name and pronouns, but Neil says that could put a child in danger.
What they're doing in school, unless it is harmful to them or others, they're bullying, they're doing something they're not doing well, you know, where you do have to interact with the parents, you still don't have to tell the parents their name. We don't question when a cisgender child comes to you and tells you that they want to go by a different name. We immediately do it.
And it's issues like that one that makes creating a statewide policy a tough hill to climb. Neil was instrumental in putting together a statewide policy proposal in 2018, Regulation 225, which was ultimately shelved due to controversy over the parental consent clause. And Neil isn't sure when another statewide policy may be proposed.
We know for a fact that there are trans kids throughout the state. Why aren't we protecting them too? Protecting them doesn't mean we don't care about their parents. Protecting them means we are trying to set up a new generation of living, happy, thriving Delaware residents. What is so difficult about that?
For now, the work remains at the district level and is taking different forms. Neil notes that some, such as Brandywine, are effectively already following policies like Christina and Red Clay, but have concerns about the potential pushback while dealing with other immediate concerns.
But I don't think right now they want to deal with the vitriol that comes from it while also dealing with, we don't have enough money. Our buildings are falling apart.
Back in Cape Henlopen, parent Diane Scarantino took matters into her own hands, advocating for her child and requesting numerous meetings with teachers and administrators.
There was some kind of mandated discipline in the policy for teachers that kind of turned their heads. That would probably prompt teachers to get moving when somebody says something.
Scarantino says the district suggested a gender support plan several years ago when her son was in elementary school. Her son's plan was revised following recent incidents to include his preferred name and pronouns, along with access to the nurse's office and administrative bathrooms when he feels unsafe using the common ones.
So it's kind of in place of policy, which it would be nice if it was added in.
Another Cape Henlopen parent and local minister, Reverend Kathy Ryan Starr, has two kids in the district. Their youngest is gender fluid. Starr also identifies as gender queer and is advocating for a concrete policy to hold all district students and staff accountable.
Right now, our teachers are going with their best guts, which is sometimes really great, which is sometimes not so great, and which is sometimes really leaves them in limbo of kids saying one thing, admin saying another, parents are saying another, and that puts teachers in a very difficult place and students in a very difficult place, and policy clarifies that.
And Starr adds kids will discover these topics one way or another.
Gender and sexuality are in school whether we like it or not, because they're talking about it anyways.
But Red Clay Board President Jose Matthews warns that just having a policy is not enough. While he believes Red Clay's policy lifted weight off of students' shoulders, there's still work to be done surrounding the culture.
Despite having protections and despite having, you know, policies and laws put in place, racism did not go away. And same with bigotry with gender nonconforming and trans folks. The bigotry that they face certainly has not gone away either.
Another social worker at Transitions Delaware, Finn Ward, adds, even kids who attend schools with policies or procedures still suffer from a culture of bullying.
It doesn't matter that the policy is more inclusive. It's the environment for these kids that is the same. And that's the dilemma. No, there's been no change in environment.
Ward says that without more buy-in to create that environment, pushback against policies that provide gender-affirming protections tells kids with those identities they're not welcome in school.
To be so real with you, I don't think I have one kid on my roster that enjoys being at school. Not one kid. All the way down to my five-year-old, I see. It just fosters a space of shame for the kids who do have those identities, or the kids who may not be out and now for sure will not come out. And they hear the narratives, they hear the politics, they go to school, they hate being trans. They hate being trans.
Fina Grimes says they often felt that way while in Indian River, but like most LGBTQ students, knew which teachers were safe to confide in about preferred names and pronouns and who they could rely on when they felt threatened. They say the goal is to make that universal.
Like ones that had better relationships with students would like honor things like that. I do think a policy obviously would make it so there is something to reference and kind of like make them kind of respect it in a way.
Or as Transitions Delaware's Reverend Carla Fleshman suggests,
it's not the kids that need to change. It's the policies and procedures that need to change and recognize that we have a very diverse community that should be celebrated, honored, and supported.
Rachel Sawicki, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Rachel. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at ways to build on programs like the Creative Vision Factory that seek to assist those facing homelessness, addiction, and mental health issues. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this month, contributor Larry Nagengast reported on the Creative Vision Factory, specifically the circumstances causing a program that helps those facing homelessness, mental health issues, and addiction to leave its current Wilmington home. That was the first in a series on the Creative Vision Factory and associated issues from the Delaware Journalism Collaborative, a partnership of local news and community organizations working to bridge divides statewide. This week, Larry Nagengast returns to complete the series with a look at possible solutions to assist programs like the Creative Vision Factory. That piece is available at DelawarePublic.org. And earlier this week, Larry joined me to discuss his reporting. So before we get into your piece, I understand there is an update on what's happening with Creative Vision Factory. What can you tell us about where things stand now?
Well, in the last time we talked about the Creative Vision Factory, we reported that it would become part of a larger peer support organization called Impact Life, and it would move at the end of June from its longtime site on Shipley Street in downtown Wilmington, most likely to an Impact Life site in Ellesmere. Since then, Impact Life has arranged to purchase a building within Wilmington for the Creative Vision Factory to continue serving Wilmington area residents who are battling housing instability, substance abuse, and/or mental health issues. However, this purchase will not be final until mid-August, and that assumes that everything goes smoothly with the settlement process. So in June, the Creative Vision Factory is going to phase out its programming on Shipley Street, and for at least 6 weeks in July and August, its clients are going to have to get to Ellesmere to avail themselves of its services. Now, Impact Life says it will provide transportation if it's needed, but you know, some of those details still remain to be resolved.
So moving on to your piece, as you looked at ways to bolster support for those with mental health and addiction issues that are served by entities like Creative Vision Factory, you found one thing may be needed more than anything else, and it's something entities like Creative Vision Factory don't offer. What is that?
Just about everyone that I interviewed said the same thing. A stable housing situation is essential for anyone in recovery from substance abuse or mental health issues. Having stable housing removes one of the largest stressors for individuals in recovery. Now, stable housing, while not a guarantee, does make it less likely that these individuals will have their recovery derailed. Housing for individuals suffering from addiction and mental health crises is in short supply, and these individuals comprise really just a small part of this much broader need in the state, a shortage of more than 20,000 affordable housing units. Now, keep in mind also that organizations like the Creative Vision Factory have never had a housing component. Their role has been to provide supportive social services, but housing has never been part of their mission.
So your piece, with that in mind, focuses mainly on one possible housing-related solution, and that is permanent supportive housing. Can you explain what that is?
Well, okay, and I think the best way to do this is to go back to the definition from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And according to HUD, permanent supportive housing is permanent housing in which housing assistance, typically long-term leasing or rental assistance, and supportive services are provided to assist households with it who have at least one member who has a disability that keeps them from achieving stability in housing. Now, these supportive services can include case management, mental health services, substance abuse treatment, health care coordination, life skills training, and employment services. To make it clear, permanent does not mean forever. It means having a lease, not just temporary housing. And supportive refers to rent subsidies and these various supportive services that are essential to helping people in need get their lives back together.
So are there any examples of this permanent supportive housing already in Delaware?
Yes, there are several. A group called Conexio Care, which is the kind of the linear descendant of the former Connections program, has 58 units throughout the state. Some of the programs of the fairly well-known Ministry of Caring in Wilmington also fit that description, and so do several of the residences that Impact Life already operates. Now, one successful program, which focuses on serving young adults who are aging out of the state's foster care system, is Lifelines 3, a project of the West End Neighborhood House in Wilmington. Now, they have 33 beds in 13 homes, most of them on the city's west side, clustered near St. Anthony's Catholic Church and St. Francis Hospital. Now, in addition to putting a roof over the heads of these young adults, Lifelines teaches basic life skills like how to go grocery shopping, how to do the laundry, and helps them find jobs and provides an array of counseling services, and it connects them to healthcare providers right there in the neighborhood. While Lifeline serves these young adults in need, this model can be replicated to serve other populations that need support, like those in recovery from substance abuse or with mental health issues.
So what are some of the challenges to creating more of this type of housing?
Well, you know, the biggest challenge here is that there are really multiple pieces to put in that are involved in putting together a permanent supportive housing program. And few of these organizations that are interested possess all of the skills needed to put those pieces together and to keep it running. To keep it simple, you've got four basic needs here. First, you need a developer or a builder who can acquire existing housing or construct new units. Next, you need a property manager who can oversee those units, handling the maintenance, the repairs, things like that. Then you need social services programming. You need counselors, psychologists, people to help find jobs, access to healthcare, and making that available to the people who are living in these units. And finally, you need a revenue stream, because few, if any, of these people who are going to be living in the housing are going to have the means to pay market rate rent. So this means qualifying for rent subsidies, contracting with state agencies for these services that are provided, and when nonprofits are running these programs, which is true in most cases, seeking donations from their supporters and grants from foundations and businesses. Most builders aren't equipped to do social services, nor do they want to. Most social service agencies aren't knowledgeable in property development. And no matter who you are, fundraising isn't easy. So it takes dedication, it takes persistence, it takes resilience, it takes a great deal of knowledge in these areas, and having a lot of partners, a whole lot of partners, to put it all together.
And there is also trying to deliver the programming that would be part of permanent supportive housing. I understand this is also kind of a substantial task to have that kind of programming in place.
Well, yeah. I just mentioned some of those programming needs, but, you know, what's crucial here, in addition to the needs themselves, is that they be easily accessible. Now, Lifelines at West End Neighborhood House is a good example of making that work. They have a combination drop-in center and office on the same block as many of these housing units. So counselors and social services specialists are there just about every day. They arrange for medical services for their residents either at St. Francis Hospital, which is just around the corner, or at Westside Healthcare, which is four or five blocks away. Now, people who are in need of these services are much more likely to use them when they're in the same building or when they're practically next door. So again, you've got folks with limited income. You don't want to have to have them travel any kind of significant distance to get there, because that increases the odds of them not getting there at all. In addition, as the experts tell me, if people have easy access to address these health and social needs, their problems are less likely to spiral out of control, which can lead to visits to an emergency room or some other form of crisis center. So, assembling these essential services is a challenge, especially when you want to gather them all under one roof and in a convenient location. But, the experts say, easy access means fewer costly and time-consuming emergency situations later, and that reduces the long-term burdens on healthcare and on our other service centers.
So having said all that, what would making more permanent supportive housing in Delaware look like? Who needs to be meaningfully involved to make it happen?
Well, I guess I'm coming back to the necessity of a little bit of the traditional Delaware way sort of thinking here, but then we've got to do something. Creating more permanent supportive housing in Delaware is going to take a coordinated effort among government and private agencies that have not collaborated very much in the past. The people who concentrate on housing don't necessarily focus on homelessness. There are some government officials who treat homelessness as an issue that is separate from substance abuse and mental health crises, even though housing stability appears to be an essential component on the road to recovery. So then what is it that we have to do? First, We need leadership at the state level. We need someone who's going to take charge. And then that leader has to pull together these people who don't talk to each other enough and who act together even less frequently. And I'm talking here about government and nonprofit experts in housing, mental health, and substance abuse. We're talking about builders and developers of affordable housing. And we're talking about folks who know the ins and outs of local planning and zoning regulations as well. No one says it's going to be easy, but many people say that it's possible. But it's going to take leadership and a sense of commitment.
And even if the state could deliver more permanent supportive housing, it really is just one part of addressing these issues, right? I mean, in particular, the overall affordable housing piece, right?
Yes, absolutely right, Tom. The annual counts that are taken show that there are more than 1,200 homeless individuals in the state, and many of them are struggling with either their mental health or substance abuse issues. And so that subgroup here accounts for really 5 or 6% of that overall need of more than 22,000 affordable housing units. Affordable housing in that broader context, you know, that we're talking about, means not just having a roof over the heads of the addicted and the mentally ill, but also shelter for teachers and restaurant workers in these pricey areas down at the beach, healthcare and emergency workers statewide who don't necessarily make high salaries but work in important professions, apprentices in the building trades. I mean, you get the picture from what I'm suggesting here. Now, when you look at it this way, creating permanent supportive housing for those with chronic disabling conditions is just a small piece of a much larger problem. But arguably, these individuals that we've been focusing on today have some of the greatest needs, and housing stability should make it much easier for them to address the major health challenges that they face.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nangest for his time this week. His piece on other solutions to address the issues of homelessness, mental health issues, and addiction that the Creative Vision Factory is working on is available at DelawarePublic.org, where you can also find the rest of the stories in this Delaware Journalism Collaborative series. Next up, Arts Playlist takes us to the Brandywine Museum of Art for a new exhibition from an acclaimed Philadelphia artist and teacher. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A Philadelphia-based artist and teacher of more than seven decades has a new exhibition at the Brandywine Museum of Art. Peter Payone's In Shadows Embrace showcases a selection of 22 prints he recently gifted to the Brandywine, drawing on themes of faith and isolation. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel is joined by Payone and Brandywine curator Audrey Lewis to learn more about the exhibit and Payone's work.
Why these particular 22 to kind of kick the exhibit off?
These prints were done in the 60s, and I did mainly etchings, and I did about, almost 100 in that decade. And I made a selection and gave, I think, just over 40 to the Brandywine because they were starting a print collection, which I don't think they had very much of before that, and they were interested in my work. Once they had those 40, they surprised me with an exhibition, which gratefully Audrey was going to curate, which I was thrilled about. And Audrey and I made this selection because of the gallery space. We selected first a portfolio I did on by Ambrose Bierce. I illustrated his Ten Commandments from the Devil's Dictionary. That alone was not big enough for the gallery. So we had to add more. We made the selection of these prints.
You are known primarily as a painter today throughout your seven-decade career, but people may be surprised by a printmaker.
Actually, I maintain three careers: a painter, a printmaker, and an educator. I started as a very young teenager, and younger, as a painter, a watercolorist. And it wasn't until I got to high school that they introduced me to printmaking. And then later, in art school, I took art education and began my teaching career, which I did for 50 years. So that printing, painting, and at my education program, they overlapped and they fed each other. In my generation, one was not a painter, one was not a printmaker or a draftsman or a sculptor. One was an artist, and an artist did it all. And I did it all. I did not specialize. The fact that I exhibited more in paintings in most of my decades was because that's what was available. In the 60s, the print world was really a very active world. But after that, it sort of died off. Print galleries closed. A lot of it had to do with the new technology of what was a print and defining it. You know, offset prints came in, digital prints came in, and the handcrafted print, people just weren't teaching it anymore. So the artists weren't using it. They were making their prints from the keyboard. So it was very different. So I had very little opportunity to continue to promote my prints.
You've mentioned the Romantic painter and printmaker Francisco Goya and artists associated with German Expressionism as some major influences.
We all came out of the human condition. That was the link. And so if I was going to learn about etching, I wouldn't go to the Cubists because they were formal. I'd go to them maybe for painting, but not for this. So Kathy Kollwitz, Goya, Klinger, a number of etchers were, you know, the people that I went to, but I gravitated to the people. I didn't search them out. I just gravitated to the people that were dealing with the human figure and the human figure in a more humanistic way than a formal way. You know, if you take a model, you sit her in the chair, that's a formal thing. And that's an art school thing. But, you know, if the model is distressed, carrying a baby, running from something, then that's an event. That's a human condition that's taking place. So the artist and the subject have an interaction.
In Shadow's Embrace, how do you feel about this exhibit and people as they go through it? And what is the kind of overriding feeling that you hope as they're walking away, they're taking with them from this?
I would say out of my entire printmaking career, and I stopped making prints about 10 years ago because it's a younger man's stunt. I don't have the muscle anymore. But all those years, I would say the body of work I did in the 1960s of prints is my most interested, that I'm interested in. Because I think not only does it say what I've always tried to say in print, but it said it in a media that I want to speak into. How people react to it, I can't determine that. We were there the day it opened. And it's very interesting. We spent as much time at exhibitions reception as I have over these 70 years. You find that most people in galleries at a reception are talking to each other. No one's looking at the art. They're seeing each other for that they haven't seen. You know, it's one-upmanship. Artists are talking, but so forth. I was very surprised that everyone was looking at the prints, and all but a handful of family members were all strangers to me. And so, you know, they didn't know who I was, and I was able to observe them. And it was very intense. I was very pleased. Now, what they went home with, I can't tell you. But the fact that they looked was good enough.
Audrey Peters' work has been featured at the Brandywine before. Talk to us a little bit about his work as an artist of roughly 70 years and the relationship that you all have with him. This must be very special putting this together.
Yes. And, you know, we began our relationship with Peter not that long ago in 2019. Somebody talked to us about his work, and Tom Payne, our director, and myself went to visit Peter's studio, and we're just kind of blown away with what we saw because, frankly, I didn't know his work because I'm more of a historical art historian. So I was just thrilled to see somebody working in a figurative tradition, but in such a contemporary, modern way. Really, we were moved by his Halloween paintings, which is what we exhibited in 2019. The theme was Halloween paintings. And what we wanted to express in that exhibition was just how Halloween may seem like a, you know, fun time, a fun day, but it's much deeper than that. And I think Peter uncovered that in his work. His work is more about the humanity in people and how on this, the Halloween exhibition was revealing maybe their innermost longings and such things. And so we really were just so thrilled at the reaction to the show. It was one of our really popular shows. It was a rather small exhibition, but it brought in so many people, and we made a small catalog, and it really entranced people. So we had a really great feedback from that. And then we developed our relationship further with Peter. He gave us a painting from that exhibition and a drawing, and then his self-portrait about a year and a half ago that is just amazing. And then he talked to us about his prints. And he had been talking to me about his prints for a couple of years, but now that the museum had decided that we were going to start collecting more prints, it was just a great opportunity. And we were very excited when Peter offered us this selection of work from his wide body of work. He gave us 42 of his own prints, and then 10 or so of another artist. And so when we saw them, it was just, I don't know, a surprise, not because it was so different from his paintings in terms of mood or anything like that, but just the power of them in black and white. And we were so excited to be able to do this exhibition as soon as we did. We wanted to get it out there very quickly. And we decided we wanted to do the exhibition this May.
An opportunity to show prints in this day is a great opportunity because they're not the kind of prints I do are not popular prints. They're not oversized. They're not lots of color. They're not done digitally. They're not decorative. They certainly don't fit in a conference room or a reception area of a corporation. They're very personal because I am basically a storyteller. And the artists you refer to, like Goya and Kathy Cohen, they all told stories. You know, it wasn't just, what am I going to do today? I mean, there was something in their lives and their time that they wanted to talk about, whether it was conscious or just because they absorbed it and it was part of their new vision. And I'm very grateful that I'm having, at this stage of my career, a print exhibit. And I think it's just wonderful of Tom Patton and Audrey Lewis to allow that to happen, because they also realize that this is something very different, very special, particularly at this time for that museum.
Thanks to Philadelphia artist Peter Payone, Brandywine Museum of Art curator Audrey Lewis, and our Carl Engel for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters, where we learn about the First State's role in a nationwide celebration of a famed hero of the American Revolution. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. 200 years ago, in 1824, the Marquis de Lafayette, one of the heroes of America's fight for independence during the Revolutionary War, began a 13-month Guest of the Nation tour of all 24 states, including Delaware. To commemorate the bicentennial of Lafayette's return to America, hundreds of events have been planned across the U.S. and in France to celebrate and educate the public about both Lafayette and France's role in America's war for independence. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon catches up with historian Kim Burdick, resident site manager for the historic Hale Burns House, for a chat about Lafayette's return.
We're talking today about the nationwide celebration of Marquis de Lafayette's return to Delaware 200 years ago in 1824. But when most people hear that name, I don't think they have maybe little to no idea who that is or why he matters. So let's start there. Who was Marquis de Lafayette, And why are we celebrating the bicentennial of his return to America as the so-called guest of the nation? And bonus points if you fit his full name into your answer, but I won't hold you to that, Kim.
Well, we'll start with Gilbert and we'll leave it there, but it's a very long name. Well, actually, he turned 20 here at the Hale Burns house, and that was on September 6, 1777. So he actually, in some ways, he ran away from France when he was a kid. The king actually told him not to come here, but he did. He had enough money, he was the richest orphan in France, that he contracted to have a ship built. And so he and his buddies sailed to America. And so when Ben Franklin, who had been the American ambassador to France, caught word that he had done this, he insisted that George Washington be Gilbert's babysitter, and he was. But they had a nice relationship because Gilbert's father had died when I think he was only 3 years old, and so he never knew his dad. And Washington had stepchildren from Martha Custis, but he didn't have kids of his own, and so they had this father-son relationship that worked out pretty well. And so after the American Revolution, and then he went home, and then he was in the French Revolution, and then he was imprisoned at Olmutz, which I'm not sure, I think might have been in Austria. And then after that, he got back involved in French politics. And so by the time that he was turning 67, he wrote to James Madison, who was then the president of the United States, and he said he'd been daydreaming about coming back to America. And Madison was pretty close to his age, and they had been army buddies at Valley Forge, which is hard to imagine, you know. But he said, well, yes, come, why not? You can help us kick off the 50th anniversary of America. So it's sort of a way to launch the 250th that's coming up soon. And by that time, there were 24 states in the United States. There hadn't been the 13 colonies when Lafayette was here when he was 20, but some of them, including Louisiana, of course, had very much interested in French American history. Some places were named for Lafayette. And so he was going to turn 67 that year, and he had a 67th birthday.
Well, you touched on this a bit, but one of the longstanding landmarks Delaware has of this time and of the Marquis is the more than 300-year-old sycamore tree beside the Hale Burns house, which is also known as the witness tree because, as you again mentioned, George Washington met with his top generals under that tree in the late summer of 1777. Can you tell us more about that meeting and its significance in this context? You said the Marquis was, what, 19 or 20 years old during that meeting?
It was his 20th birthday on that same day.
Wow.
the tree is still there. It's totally hollow. If it didn't have a wooden panel on a spike, you and I could stand up inside that tree. It's pretty big and pretty old. It was already full grown when George Washington had his meeting here. And Daniel Burns was actually a Quaker miller and not the kind of person that would normally host a council of war, but he didn't have much choice. So one day there was a knock on the front door, and it was a staff person of George Washington's who said, "So, Mr. Pacifist Quaker, sir, we're having a council of war at your house at 5. Bye." And then what the heck's he supposed to do? He had 4 or 5 kids and a wife. So anyways, he did. And so whether Dinah Burns and her children went up to the Red Clay Creek to Daniel's brother's house or whether they were hiding here somewhere, we really don't know. But the tree was there. And the painting that Bryant White did shows Washington staff people under the tree. And it also shows Washington and Lafayette in front of the tree, in front of the door. So it's kind of a neat thing that there's a tree that's that old that actually was witnessing Lafayette having been here.
Getting back to this nationwide celebration of Lafayette's return, There are hundreds of celebrations or planned events in other cities, you know, like New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Charleston, St. Louis, New Orleans, Savannah. Not to mention, you know, there's all these other small towns that Lafayette visited. You recently held a Thinking Out Loud coffee hour back in February to plan all this in Delaware, essentially. Can you tell us about that coffee hour and how planning is going with roughly 5 months to go until Delaware's celebration date of October 6th?
Pretty well, actually. We've been talking about it for a while, but because we're known as a place related to Lafayette, it wasn't too hard. But at the moment, the plan is to have a ticketed breakfast at Hagley on October 6th at 9. And Hagley's been very nice about that. And then people will go over to the Robinson House in Claymont, which is where in 1824 he came over the Pennsylvania border into Claymont. And the plan is to start there. And 1st Delaware Regiment, the reenactors, will be spending the night up there at the Robinson House. So they'll be cooking and moving around in their costumes and stuff. And there's a lovely family, Alicia Gibson is the mother, and she has two daughters, Bea and Ellie, that I've known since they were in second grade or something. And now they're almost grown-ups. They're in high school going to proms and things. But Alicia and her daughters will be doing projects with kids. So if you live around Claymont, you should definitely go up there, and they'll be cooking and doing things. And then when Lafayette gets there, theoretically being brought by Chuck Schwamm, who's the National Executive Director of American Friends of Lafayette, he'll be greeted by some local Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, and CAR is Children of the American Revolution, and also a reenactor from Dover, Tom Welch, who portrays Alan McLean. He will be coming up to the Robinson House to be one of the greeters of Lafayette, who back in the day, he actually knew Lafayette when Lafayette was a young soldier at Barron Hill and Lafayette, and went to Valley Forge after that. After we leave Robinson House, they're going to stop at Brandywine Village, and that beautiful string of bluestone rock buildings there by Concord Pike and Philadelphia Pike, that was an authentic section of housing. And actually, there was some war headquarters in the Tattnall House and so forth. So they'll be having a program there. And then we'll move down to Delaware Historical Society on Market Street, where a Black reenactor from Williamsburg will portray James Armistead Lafayette. Lafayette helped him to become freed from slavery. And so James Armistead named himself his last name Lafayette. So he'll be there. And then we'll go to Newcastle. And the Van Dyke House, actually, Lafayette attended a DuPont family wedding there. So it's all a pretty interesting way to get Delaware history as part of the puzzle.
It really sounds like this event could be put on tomorrow, Kim. You guys are just so ready.
We're ready.
Well, you know, what exactly, you know, as we wrap up, in your words, in your view, what exactly is the goal of this celebration, Kim? Is it to educate the public, to keep this history alive, you know, to shine a light on Lafayette's importance? Is it a combination of those things or something more? What's the goal here?
Well, it's kind of fun when you think about Delaware being the lower three counties of Pennsylvania. And though at that time period, it was still in people's minds, the lower three counties of Pennsylvania was separated in 1776. So there's a lot of people that I knew in Pennsylvania who had never been farther than Concord Mall. But people always say, well, Delaware. And then they ask me, do you mean Delaware County, dear? I'm like, no. So, and they know Delaware from passing through from Philadelphia to go to DC or something like that. So it's kind of, in my mind, a nice way to get Delaware's name out there, because we actually were a pretty interesting, although very small state. But 24 states are involved, so it's a way to really kick off the 250th, like commemorating the 50th anniversary of the country.
Thanks to historian Kim Burdick with the Hale Burns House and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel and Rachel Sawicki, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.